afternoon. It's Tuesday, September 23rd, 2003, and coming to you live from WGMU and George Mason University, Fairfax, Virginia, this is Conflict. Welcome to Conflict. I'm your host, Sean Dunning. It is my pleasure to introduce our guest for this afternoon, Mr. Thomas Dunn. During the Vietnam War, Mr. Dunn commanded the U.S. Navy's underwater demolition team and later served in one of the United States' most elite special forces, the Navy SEALs. Today, however, he is a leading expert in the practice and training of cooperative problem-solving techniques and other forms of non-adversarial conflict resolution. He holds a bachelor's degree in philosophy and sociology from DePaul University and a master's in international relations and the history of political thought from Georgetown. He has taught political science, socio-technical work systems, organizational psychology, and conflict management at various universities and agencies, and he has served as a consultant for the U.S. Congress and the White House. In 1992, Mr. Dunn founded a revolutionary initiative between the IRS and the National Treasury Employees Union in an effort to encourage cooperative problem-solving both within the IRS and with taxpayers. Over 10,000 employees received training under his guidance in less than 5 years. He was presented with the agency's highest award. In recent years, he has provided training and consulting services to numerous organizations and communities from Mexico to the United States and Canada, all the way to Belfast, Northern Ireland. In an extraordinary effort of reconciliation, Mr. Dunn recently led a U.S.-Vietnamese team to a former minefield in Vietnam to plant a peace forest. Ladies and gentlemen, the accomplishments of this man stretch far beyond the limits of our time today. So, without any further ado, welcome to the program, Tom.
Thanks very much, Sean.
Well, it's really a pleasure to have you on the show today. There's so much we could talk about. And I thought perhaps we could start just by a little kind of introduction of your past. Tell us maybe a little bit about your days back in Vietnam.
Well, that lead-in of the guys in training, in BUDS, as they call it, out in Coronado, really brought back memories of lots of fun in the sun on the beach just west of San Diego. And that was right after I'd come out of college and gone through Officer Candidate School. After the training for underwater demolition team, I did go to Vietnam twice. First time right after training for 6 months. And we were primarily doing reconnaissance of beaches for potential landings. Sometimes we'd work with the Marine Reconnaissance Group. I served as translator as we talked with the local civil defense people. Mm-hmm. So our basic mission was reconnaissance. I came home, went back again about a year later for a second six-month tour.
And and that was in the underwater demolition team, is that right?
Yes, that was with UDT 11.
And that was before the Navy SEALs even existed.
They were just getting started at that time. Yeah.
And then when the Navy SEALs came along, you became part of that.
Right, Right. I was with SEAL Team 4 as a reserve officer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, we have a lot to talk about, and I can't wait to get to your insights into certainly your expertise with cooperative problem-solving techniques. But it, I think, certainly to me, you know, to the average individual, I would think it seems a bit counterintuitive for someone coming from an elite, you know, military special forces background to all of a sudden be a leading expert in this new world of cooperative, non-adversarial ways of addressing conflict. And I guess I'm not suggesting that they can't both coexist. And surely you think back on your days in the military fondly. But I'm wondering what transformed, or, you know, maybe you weren't transformed. What took you from being a Navy SEAL to a cooperative problem-solving expert?
Sure. Well, no, I get asked that question a lot. It's a fair question. And from my perspective, there's a lot that the military and the people in conflict resolution have in common. They're both involved in solving problems. We used to jokingly say in the teams that there's no problem that cannot be resolved with an adequate amount of plastic explosives. So what we differ on isn't our fundamental purpose, and I think that allows for a lot of respect among the between those communities, and I'm still in touch with a lot of people in the military community that have high regard for people who are doing non-adversarial problem solving. Mm-hmm. Is there skepticism on the part of the military towards this approach? You bet. There's skepticism on the part of the entire society.
Why do you think that is?
Well, the recent issue of Military History Quarterly tells mm-hmm. the tale, I think, as clearly as anything. The previous issue contained an article by a military historian on the necessity of war for solving international problem. This latest issue was a response by another military historian who is involved in the academy and teaching conflict resolution. And his point is that so many of the possibilities for collaborative problem solving just are overlooked because of our habit, because of the tradition that political and military adversarial approaches are the traditional ways for resolving international issues. So just the brand newness of the collaborative mm-hmm. approach it would cause people to be very skeptical until we can demonstrate a few more successes than we have so far.
And, you know, I don't want to go too far, you know, down this line, but you must be presented, certainly with your background in both realms, with the, you know, those proverbial questions of, well, you know, where do you draw the line in terms of appropriateness? I mean, could we have addressed someone like Hitler with non-adversarial manners?
Yes, that question is asked a lot, and no one can say, well, I've got an alternative to that one. Will we ever be able to deal with a Hitler in a non-adversarial way? There are different opinions on that, but it's certainly reasonable to be skeptical at this point. Mm-hmm. I think the larger issue is that the profession of collaborative problem solving or conflict management or conflict resolution is so new, we don't even have an agreed on title for it yet. It's so new that the concepts are still being developed, the cases are still being studied and tried, and we're in our infancy. 30 years ago, there was no Association for Conflict Resolution. Mm-hmm. Now there is the Association for Conflict Resolution in the U.S. has 12,000 members. 30 years ago, there were no academic programs in the United States, or to my knowledge, in the rest of the world, in this area. Now there are well over 150.
The first, as I understand, the very first graduate program in conflict analysis and resolution is right here at George Mason University.
How could we not mention that? And one of my great heroes is a man who's Jim Lowy, who is fundamental in not only in getting that program started, but in envisioning the possibilities of the program. And I think that's what causes skepticism today, in that the vision isn't It needs to be created, and, mm-hmm. and some people have that in their mind. But unless you see, for example, looking at such situations at the Sinai peace process back 25 years ago, and can see that there are some concrete successes, unless you're aware of that, and even if you are, it's very easy to be skeptical. So we're just going through our infancy phase, and that just means we have to work hard to earn our spurs.
A little trial and error, perhaps.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I get great comfort when I realize that that's true of other professions, too, even the old ones. Mm-hmm. They say that doctors are practicing, and that's a word used advisedly. Mm-hmm. Even in the hardest of science, there's still leading edges and mysterious places, so it's a matter of degree. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of them for us who are in the field of helping people sit down and solve problems together.
And these concepts are I mean, for me, inspiring. I mean, I'm certainly focusing on this, you know, kind of with my career and such, and I believe I have a faith that there's possibility to do things differently. You know, I'm wondering, with your wealth of experiences, and again going back to kind of I can't get out of my mind that you were once a highly trained, you know, elite military.
Sure.
With all due respect, fighting machine. And in those times, back in, you know, we talked a little bit before the program and you were sharing some stories, but I wonder if there are any stories or kind of moments you'd like to share about your time, you know, back in the teams when, you know, did you have any experiences that maybe suggested that, you know, that gave you a different insight into human nature or,
sure.
you know, something beyond what we all might just automatically assume is the case in war.
Sure. Yeah. Yes. As a matter of fact, I have. I'm reminded of the old saying that a conservative is a liberal who's been mugged, and my experience was kind of the opposite of that. That I had the experience of seeing just what a horrible way war is to resolve differences, and I think that is what creates a bond even today between people in our field and people who know war, who know what it's like to be on the firing line, because they know, man, they may not think there's a better way, but they know that that's one horrible way. My particular experience was during my first tour in Vietnam, when I went in with a group of Marines. We were in two rubber boats, went into a beach near Da Nang. Mm-hmm. Our purpose was to go inland and talk with some of the local civil defense forces and find out what was going on there and so forth. And we landed at high tide, and we started across this very wide beach, maybe 100 yards. We got about 50 yards across it, and we're taken under fire by automatic weapons. So we all hit the deck. We couldn't see anybody shooting at us. We were totally out in the open, just a mm-hmm. flat beach. The shooters were up in the tree line ahead of us. My first reaction really surprised me. I think every young person going into the military during their training wonders, mm-hmm. Maybe I'm doing okay during training, but how will I be under fire? Will I be heroic? Mm-hmm. Will I be cowardly? Will I be what? It was none of that. The feeling that I had was a pure hatred for those people that mm-hmm. were shooting, and just sheer anger and wanting to kill them. Fortunately, I was second in command. I was the equivalent of a second lieutenant. I was an ensign at the time. The first lieutenant marine who was in charge gave us a command to not fire, just to maintain our defense perimeter, which was totally useless, really, because we were totally exposed. But he noticed that as long as we didn't move, they didn't shoot. And because the tide was now going out, our rubber boats were high and dry, and there wasn't much we could do by way of getting out of there. So he wisely decided we're going to just stay right here. And we did all day. We watched that sun go across the sky, and we inspected the little crabs that came up out of the sand in front of our nose.
You were just laying there in the sand, not
all
moving.
Day. All day.
Wow.
Yeah. One time I threw some sea rations to a buddy of mine, and the fire started again. And so that made the point that we were communicating very clearly mm-hmm. that they simply didn't want us to come in any closer. So we waited. Tide came back in. And the lieutenant gave us a command. He said, gentlemen, what we're going to do is leave our weapons on the sand here. We're going to stand up. We're going to turn around, pick up our weapons, and walk back into the ocean. And we did. And it was a memorable moment. We got in the rubber boats and went back to our mothership, which was a couple of miles at sea because the gradient was such there that large ships just couldn't come in close, so they couldn't give us any support. That evening, I was reading the message traffic in the communications shack on board the ship, and there was a lot of traffic that had gone back and forth during the day while we were on the beach. What's happening? This is supposed to be friendly territory. Why are our guys being taken under fire? What should we do about it? And one message particularly just caught my eye, and it was from an aircraft carrier that was part of our battle group saying it's possible that these people might be shooting at our people because of what happened yesterday. Well, the day before, it turns out one of our aircraft from that aircraft carrier had flown over that village and a can of napalm, a bomb that had failed to drop during a bombing run, fell off over the village by mistake.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it's a little, it's understandable why they were firing back.
Well, it struck me that way. Yeah. It, and I've been learning from that incident to this day. It took me years to realize. I mean, right away I knew something's wrong with this picture, that I wanted to kill these people who could have killed us and didn't, and turned out they had reason to and still didn't. The more I thought about it, the more I realized that I really owed my life to those people in the sense that they had us right in the palm of their hand, and they decided not to close that fist. So when I realized that what a paradox this was, that there really were no bad guys in that picture at all, and yet here we were, it seemed to me a microcosm of a number of other things that I experienced while I was over there. So when it came time to get out of the Navy, I decided, well, what I want to do is work for alternative ways to resolve differences. It was awkward to even say those words at the time. Mm-hmm. There was no discipline. There was no field of conflict resolution.
And the colleagues whom you were surrounded by, you know, certainly didn't operate in those manners.
I think part of it is your genes. You know, why do you want to, or being a middle child, who knows why? A lot of things that go into choosing the professions that we go into. That was my reason for going into this. And I went into political science. It was the closest thing that I could think of that might be useful. It turned out that political science had not been visited by the collaborative ways of looking at things. We were still talking about realpolitik and the military being an extension of diplomacy. So it took me quite a while to discover, I began to discover the field as it began to emerge. And I first saw it in the form not of conflict resolution as such, but organization development, which came out of World War II and where it actually started with group therapy and then developed into a profession that's widely respected today, that's very effective in helping people within organizations learn to work well together, get better work done, and get more job satisfaction at the same time. So over time, I kind of migrated from organization development into this field of conflict resolution.
Recently, you led a team of both U.S. and Vietnamese citizens to a former minefield in Vietnam. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was up in what was called I Corps during the war, right on the demilitarized zone between North and South Vietnam, just west of a little town called Dong Ha in Quang Tri Province. And it had been the headquarters of the 3rd Marine Division. During the war, there had been many battles there. A lot of people fought North Vietnamese Army, regular troops, Viet Cong, American troops, etc. And as a result of that backing and forthing, there was a lot of ordnance still on the ground there. So I was working at that time with a group called Peace Trees. They're out of Bainbridge Island near Seattle on the west coast, the Earth Stewards Network, Peace Trees Network. And so what we did was talk with our own government here, the State Department, the Pentagon, and then with the People's Republic of Vietnam embassy people here, worked out an agreement whereby the Vietnamese Army cleared about 6 acres outside the town of Dong Ha of ordnance. They found over 100 pieces of live ordnance in those 6 acres. And wow. Then we went over and planted a couple thousand trees together, both as a sign of reconciliation, excuse me, and as a real as a response to a real need there. So many of the forests have been were decimated during the war and haven't grown back. A lot of the earth is compacted there because of the heavy B-52 bombing. It's hard for things to grow there. So and this is a proud, they need reforestation. They needed a place for kids to be able to play safely. About one kid a month loses usually a limb rather than their life to live ordnance there, because as much as mom and dad say, don't go there, don't touch this kind of thing, of course, kids don't quite believe that. So there are many purposes, and now I'm told those trees that were planted only 5 years or so ago are up to 20, 30 feet. It's great wow. growing country uh-huh. when you have the right conditions.
Did you feel, I mean, in doing this trip, I know you were, through another organization, but did you feel some sort of responsibility that, you know, based on your participation during the war in Vietnam?
Oh, I think we're all responsible, mm-hmm. whatever we did back during that period. And I think that we perpetuate the downside often by challenging each other. What were you doing back then?
Mm-hmm.
I think most of the time, most people do just about the best they know how to do. Mm-hmm. And that meant some went to Canada and some shot up dope to pretend it wasn't here, and some went to Vietnam. All kinds of things that people did. So I certainly felt accountable in that sense. I know that I was doing the best I could back in those times. I know that there were horrors that occurred. I know that we have not yet as a country really looked straight at that experience. I think there's so many lessons to be learned that don't involve putting ourselves down at all. But I think just as individuals, we can learn and grow only once we accept that we are basically good people and we make mistakes sometime. I think that's true of ourselves as a country.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that when we get to the point where we can really look straight at that and say, you know, with the best of intentions, we did make a few mistakes. In my opinion, they were not tactical mistakes of how we fought mm-hmm. the war, whether the reporters should have been in there or not, but they were mistakes of how does the world leader, militarily and economically, that has this wonderful history of democracy, how do we deal in this wild and woolly world where others don't share those values, where there are bad people out there, and at mm-hmm. the same time there are a lot of just plain complex problems out there that have to do with nationalism and nation building. Mm-hmm. So what's the wise way for us to be true leaders in helping ourselves and other countries mm-hmm. resolve differences? I think there's a lot we could learn there.
Do you think we have learned or demonstrated
no.
as a democracy that we have learned?
No, no. I think we're still kind of stuck mm-hmm. on, as in large part, on the use of brute force when we get frustrated. I think part of our mm-hmm. strength as a country is that we have such energy and such vision. I think that the danger in that is that we can be very impatient sometimes and move ahead without taking into consideration some of the side issues.
Mm-hmm.
There are many, many, many people who think, hey, wait, There is a better way. I think we are evolving. I see, you know, a lot of the language that we use in our day-to-day life. The fact that Montgomery County, Maryland, right across the river from here, has just set up a whole conflict resolution program for its community, and it's slowly expanding, and there's such readiness there for it. The fact that the Internal Revenue Service, of all agencies, was hungry to learn to resolve conflict in collaborative fashions. All of those experiences give me reason to believe that we are progressing, for sure. But I think politically, as a country, our official government policy, unfortunately, hasn't changed that much, in my view. Mm-hmm. I think it's a matter of time. If these ideas, if it really is possible in many, many, many cases, as I believe, for countries to sit down and solve problems together without violence, and enough folks keep working at that, the proof will be in the pudding. Mm-hmm. I think that's how our nation will change.
Well, you mentioned something that I find quite encouraging, and you pointed out that really those of us who, you know, work differently to solve problems all have a similar goal in mind. Ostensibly, we all have perhaps a vision of world peace in mind, but we have different ideas of how to achieve that. I know I have a brother who is an officer in the Air Force, and he was a weapons special, I forget his exact title, basically a navigator on a B-1 bomber in the recent conflict in Iraq. And I have a cousin who flies F-18s in the Navy, and I respect them both greatly. And I know that their intentions are the best, as are mine. Though it really comes down to how we go about addressing problems. And you know, I wonder, do you have a perspective on again, where do you draw that line? Could you imagine a world with no military?
No.
So where do you draw that line?
I draw the line.
What is really appropriate?
I find it useful to think of the world. I mean, how can we get our mind around you know, this planet with 4 billion people and a couple hundred countries? I certainly can't. So I like to think in analogies about my own community, my own county, my own city. And there, I cannot imagine myself the community ever getting to the point where I wouldn't want to see a police officer on the street with that 9mm on their hip. I am so clearly made aware of the possibilities in our own communities that we're not tapping into right now for collaborative problem solving, that I certainly can see communities that in which force and incarceration are needed much less than they are now. How far does that go? Hey, who knows? I don't know. Nobody knows, because we're predicting the future at that point. What I do know is this whole process of collaborative problem solving or cooperative problem solving is just so little used at this point. The use is starting to grow. I have very close relatives in the military at the same time, and I share with you that view of tremendous respect for them and gratitude for them.
Absolutely.
I think, and those two articles in this latest issue of the Military History Quarterly and the previous one, I think they go to what may be the heart of the matter. There, our traditional view of international war is that there are evil people in the world, and that's why we have war. There are good people, there are bad people. And given that frame of reference, it pretty well closes in the conversation around alternatives. Are there bad people in the world? Will there always be? I think so, just as there will be in the community. And we get to define bad as people who are violating fundamental peace of the community and rights of individuals. At the same time, I think we are becoming more and more wise about some of the other causes of strife that go beyond the personalities of individual leaders or individual terrorists. We know that kids coming out of poverty tend to have higher rates of crime and drug use and alcoholism and a very difficult situation. So by extension, I think it doesn't take a whole lot of wit to speculate that maybe international injustices and people not being able to put food on their plates and, frankly, our support of some regimes that that really repress their own people, which we do for very logical reasons, for our own security, but I think short-term vision. I think that's why we wind up in those situations. That dynamic makes sense to me, would cause people in those countries who are being repressed resent us mm-hmm. and our support of the people that are repressing them. So I think that to the extent that we look beyond the evildoers and acknowledge them and be accountable and be protect ourselves from that and look at the economic causes of some of the historical causes, some of the differences between cultures and ethnicity, mm-hmm. there are some very complex causes of war, in my view, that go way beyond just evil people. To the extent that people see complexity in international relations, to that extent, I think we begin to broaden our view as to the array of approaches and the need for a wise and flexible strategy that we would bring into play over the long haul. And my view is that just as we don't know how fewer police officers we might need in our community mm-hmm. to the extent that we learn to deal with these issues, we don't know to what extent world peace is possible. But can we move forthrightly in that direction? Absolutely.
Well, I suppose if we know anything, we know that, that sheer brute force is certainly not going to lead to the peace that we may all hope for. So
it's worth exploring other ways. And it does certainly get evil people out of power. So, mm-hmm. you know, there are. Mm-hmm. Question is, shall we look only at short-term situations or the longer term? To me, that's and the brute force. The piper is always paid, and we have to pay for that when we choose to do it, and that might be a wise decision in cases. But we need to be aware that we do. Whoever uses force needs to pay the piper down the road for that.
Well, we're going to go ahead and take a short break, and when we come back, I'd like to take advantage of your presence here and talk about some of the ins and outs of what cooperative problem solving is really all about. Maybe get a general outline and hopefully for our listeners discuss some techniques that maybe they could apply in their own life.
Sure. So, and some examples of how it's really working
absolutely,
in the real world.
Examples would be great. Absolutely. So we'll be back in just a few minutes.
Okay, Sean.
Good afternoon. We're here on WGMU coming from George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia, and this is Conflict. This afternoon, our guest is Mr. Tom Dunn, former Navy SEAL and present-day cooperative problem-solving expert. We just heard some fascinating insights into where he's come from in terms of that I would think of it as a life evolution, and certainly it's inspiring to hear where you've gone with your experiences. And what I'd like to get to now is just some very kind of solid, down-to-earth skills that anybody out there listening today could really apply to their own lives. And I guess we'll start just by asking, what is cooperative problem solving?
As the name indicates, it's a process of acknowledging that you and I have a problem, that's a normal. Welcome to the real world. People have problems, and that there is a possibility that if I can decide to attack the problem rather than attacking you right out of the box, and perhaps listen to your point of view. What a concept! Very simple, but radically.
Wait, back up. But I'm right. I mean, come on. What if I'm right? Why? You know, why should I listen to you? I mean, I have the answer.
Well, I'm very interested in hearing your answer. As a matter of fact, why don't you talk to me a little bit about what is it that you want in this situation?
Wow. You mean you're going to listen to me?
Well, I definitely want to listen to you. I'm not saying that I'm going to agree with you, but I am absolutely committed to not only listening to, but understanding your point of view. And who knows? It may well be that we can find some solution.
You know, I got to tell you, Tom, I mean, that was completely unplanned.
We're ready for that,
huh? It's kind of fun, but it was amazing. I mean, I've trained in mediation and some various conflict resolution principles. But just right there to do that, just to assume that stance, to do a little role play, I actually felt something happen when I basically challenged you and you said, well, okay, I do want to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, and but we do. I experienced that as very real as well. People do. I do when I'm in a conflict, and I don't mean to say that I remember to do this all the time because our emotions come up, our ego gets involved, our defensiveness. And so it requires real discipline on my part, on everyone's part, who wants to practice cooperative problem solving. And when we drop the ball on it, we've got a choice to either throw the thing out or beat up on ourselves or just acknowledge that, I dropped the ball. Let me pick it up and run with it again. Mm-hmm. And maybe I didn't listen too well to you over these last couple minutes, but let me see if I can get back on track again here. So, what people find is that there are really two dimensions to a problem and to solving a problem. And the one is the problem itself and what is the solution. And that's the part that we tend to focus almost exclusively on. Of course, the other part is the relationship. And my own sense of being respected and your sense of being respected. I think that that's the tougher part. I think that my mom used to say there are at least 7 solutions for every problem, and I think she's been proven right over and over again when we can get to that point. But she also used to say, there are 2 sides to every story. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's the 51% of the solution, is creating a situation in which both parties or all the parties can get their point of view out on the table, be able to tell their story, be able to say, here's my issue, here's my concern. However we solve this problem, here's what needs to happen for me. And it's just for people to be able to be heard. I think when that happens, well, you said you felt different instantly.
And I was just playing around.
Yeah, we both were. Yet in real time mediations, I'm sure you're a mediator, you've experienced this, that when the parties get to the point, and they don't always get there, as you know, mm-hmm. but when they do get to the point where both parties can say, yes, that's what I'm trying to say. Mm-hmm. So something happens. I can't measure it. I can't weigh it, but there's a shift in the room. And our guts experience it, and people's eyes change, people's faces change. And at that point, I think what happens is that people have stepped up to another level, whereas they know that they don't have to argue just to get their point of view anymore. And somehow it becomes possible now for the conversation to shift from, do I get my way or do you get your way, from there to, okay, how do we figure out how to handle this in a way that will satisfy both of us. Mm-hmm. So it's a very different game that's being played. It's a very different attitude that's brought to the game, and it can only happen, in my experience, when people know that they've been heard. And it tends to happen when people know that they've been heard. It's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Well, you say that we can't prove this. We can't necessarily demonstrate it as widespread as maybe we can with war or other approaches, mm-hmm. but just in our everyday lives. I mean, can you give us any examples of this being successful?
Yeah. Oh, sure. Let me actually, if you don't mind, let me start with war, because and it is more difficult. There are many more factors involved, but I think that the Camp David Accords represent a classic example of how countries can come to this point. And the proof is in the pudding. That to this day, of course, the argument there was who owns the Sinai Peninsula, Israel or Egypt? And the issue was resolved there. And to this day, all these years later, there is no fighting in the Sinai. And there's good reason for that, because the solution had many dimensions, but the key ones were that the Sinai was going to belong to Egypt, as it had for thousands of years, but Israel was going to get reassured that it would not, that the Sinai would not be used as an invasion path by the Egyptians, as it had been previously, because there'd be UN troops there, and because there'd be no major weapons there, and that the UN troops would be there to monitor all of that. So there are troops, American troops in the Sinai. There are other UN troops in the Sinai now from all over the world, and they've got very little to do, because there was such, that agreement was not just a piece of paper. It was based on logic. It was based also on the parties, Sadat and Begin, having been heard, and their countries realizing that their fundamental interests were heard. So it's an agreement that has heart in it.
Now, you made a point there. Their countries understood that the fundamental interests had been heard or addressed. I know there are examples in that region in the Middle East where the leaders have been able to come together, and between the two of them, with whatever process results with this, they may come to what may be a logical agreement, but assassinations by their own people have followed, because they were, the leader was seen as, you know, giving in to the other side or compromising their own interests.
Sure, and that was, of course, true of Anwar Sadat. He was assassinated a couple of years later. Hey, nobody said that this approach wasn't going to have dangers to it. You know, we used to say in the teams, if it was easy, anybody could do it.
But I think what I find interesting there is the process can work between people.
Yeah.
And it's not that it can't work between larger groups or countries or, you know, between leaders with large constituencies, but it seems perhaps an evolution for conflict resolution is to find ways to make this process work on mass scales.
Yeah, a couple thoughts on that. One is how complex the situation is. It is even in families. So we start talking about international relations. Complex. And I think one of the encouraging signs there is that the people in the conflict resolution field are starting to work with people in related fields, politics, political science, and sociology, and economics. Because all these factors come into play. I think another complexity is that it's much easier to have a decision endorsed by a people when there is a true democracy. That's certainly not true of Egypt. It's true for Israeli citizens in Israel. You didn't have, I spoke a little too quickly there, you didn't have full and complete support of the Egyptian people by any means for that. At the same time, the agreement itself has withstood many regime changes since then. But what this leads to is the importance of democracy, of truly representative governments being developed in other parts of the world. And there's where I think that we, as a leader of countries, can have tremendous influence. And I think that we would do well to look at the opportunities that we have to genuinely foster representative governments, whatever forms, in other countries, as opposed to perhaps sometimes we put our own immediate economic interests in the forefront, or tactical, political, military concerns in the forefront, and kind of overlook the fact that people are not being truly represented in these countries. It's a balancing act, but I think the more we see it as that and put our effort into the longer term issues, then we create conditions in which it's more possible to create true agreements between countries.
So to bring this down to the interpersonal level or kind of community level, with just everyday conflict, you know, not necessarily even violent conflict, just everyday disagreements that we have, and, you know, grudges that we hold against people because of them, and et cetera, et cetera.
Sure.
What can cooperative solving approaches tell us how to deal with that?
I can give you an example from my own experience. A number of years ago, we had some next-door neighbors who put a note in our mailbox that was a pretty, my wife and I found fairly offensive. It happened that they were both husband and wife attorneys, and this was a very proper and correct note saying that we had an attractive nuisance in our backyard, and that if it wasn't removed forthwith, that there would be all sorts of dire legal proceedings to follow.
Uh-huh.
We knew these people for years, you know. I thought, is this a joke, you know? But the fact is that we had had some construction going on in our mm-hmm. backyard, and it wasn't a joke. Well, I went over and knocked on the door, went in and sat down, and we had some real words as to how my first concern was, what's going on that you would send this offensive note? I mean, mm-hmm. I was very upset about that. And they were very conciliatory about that. They literally did not realize how that note could be itself offensive. It was just their stock and trade. Mm-hmm. That's how, mm-hmm. you know, and you deal with neighbors in the same fair mm-hmm. and equitable way as you do with a client, you know.
Right.
So that really shocked them. I said, oh, Tom, we did not mean to upset you and your wife, you know. So that was an eye-opener. Then we talked about the construction in the backyard, and there was indeed a problem. They had been looking at it from their side of the fence and from the perspective of having three small children. We had been looking at it from our side of the fence, and our kids had all grown and moved out at that time. So we literally perceived two different situations. The problem wasn't in one of ill will. It was simply one of seeing things differently. And the solution was our sitting down together, listening to each other's point of view, and we worked it out.
So you were able to get past that and no hard feelings after that?
It certainly took, generally, yes. We shook hands. As I recall, there were actually a few hugs that were exchanged. Did it put a little tension on our relationship, a little kind of self-consciousness for a while? You bet. But, yes, mm-hmm. in time, we got past it.
Now, I know you do a lot of workshops and consulting with all types of folks all over
right.
the world, and you do workshops that last, you know, from hours to days.
Right.
We have about 3 minutes. What can you tell us about a general process,
sure.
just to kind of give us an image in our mind, a general process sure. of what a cooperative problem-solving approach would be?
Sure. Well, I'm working with Montgomery County Conflict Resolution Center, which is dedicated to providing services to anyone throughout the county who wants to use cooperative problem-solving. And what they are seeing is that there are many processes in the county that themselves do not encourage cooperative problem-solving and maybe even discourage it. And step by step, the Conflict Resolution Center is starting to work with the county government, first on in settings where it's important just to bring people together where they can hear each other's point of view. And as time goes on, what we envision is creating settings in which people can actually solve problems together. So looking down the road, I can give as an example the whole process of land use. There, in every community around the country, there is a land use protocol, mm-hmm. problem-solving protocol, which is called variance. If you want to get a variance to a particular regulation in the community, you have to go before a board. And it tends to be a fairly formal structure, and oftentimes neighbors are literally pitted against neighbors by the process itself, and people walk away very upset.
Mm-hmm.
It is possible in many communities around the country have done this, to create a variance land use dispute a process that brings the parties together and encourages mutual listening, identifying what are the underlying interests rather than simply arguing positions, and using creative problem-solving, brainstorming techniques so that the parties themselves can come up with agreements that make sense to them and that fall within the realm of the regulations that are on the books. Without that process, we tend to fall back on our default position is adversarial approach. So simply by redesigning the process and providing facilitation services, we're talking wholesale collaborative problem solving now rather than just our family and the family next door who happened to have a little training in cooperative problem solving. That would just be one example.
So I guess it's fair to say that we're all well-versed enough in adversarial approaches.
Yeah.
It's time for
it's
us
in
to...
It's in our bones. It's in our culture.
Maybe pick up some new methods.
Sure.
Well, Tom, I hate to say it, but we are just about out of time here, and it's been absolutely fascinating discussion. I'm sure we could go on for hours discussing these concepts and ideas and to get more examples. Do you have any suggestions for where people could go online, perhaps, to get to get information?
Sure. I do work with a nonprofit group called Search for Common Ground. We're about 400 people in about a dozen countries around the world, including the U.S. And so that's a great website, just searchforcommonground.org, sfcg.org. We have a particular training program that can be done by people in their local communities. The whole package is there, and it's downloadable for free. You can go on Google, call up Search for Common Ground Cooperative Problem Solving. If you write all that in your little Google box, you'll see that program come up. I'd be happy to answer any questions that people might have. You can email me on sfcg.org. That's T-Dunne, T-D-U-N-N-E, at sfcg.org. That stands for Search for Common Ground. There's a wonderful book that is the revolutionary book in this whole field. Came out 20 years ago called Getting to Yes. You can find that in 99 languages, a large number of languages around the world, and I would encourage that. There's an Association for Conflict Resolution. You can find that on Google. There's the Institute for Conflict Analysis and Resolution right here. And I'm blanking on the website, CRENET, C-R-E-N-E-T, that will just give you all kinds of information on the field. There's the National Association for Community Mediation. Look them up. And,
well, we're here at Conflict Radio. We're working on a website, actually, where these programs will be archived, and eventually we'll have this show as well as others archived online, and we'll have these links up there as well. And with that said, if any listeners out there have any suggestions or comments to share regarding these programs, feel free to send an email to ideas@conflictradio.org. And with just a little bit of time left, I have a few announcements to make.
If I may, in closing, I would encourage anyone out there who's interested in this field to jump on in, try it out. We need you. The world needs you. And there are a thousand ways to make a contribution. And for those folks who might think, yeah, but you can't earn a living on it, let it be known that I've raised 7 children over the last 30 years doing this kind of conflict resolution work. Can be done.
Fantastic. Well, with that said, thank you so much for coming on the program today, Tom. It's really a pleasure to have you, and perhaps we can have you back someday in the future.
Be happy to.
Well, folks, that's about it. Next week, tune in for Conflict to hear Building Bridges of Dialogue. We'll hear from Dr. Amer Abdallah and Julie Ryan Silva from the Washington, D.C. area, who are making extraordinary efforts to build mutual understanding between citizens of the United States and Iraq. They will share insights from recent visits to Baghdad and discuss their dialogue projects. Again, if you'd like to submit questions ahead of time, please send them to questions@conflictradio.org. I'm Sean Dunning. Thanks for listening.